Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. This is Westchester on the Level with your host, Hezzy Eris.
Good morning, everybody. Today is Tuesday. It's February 19th at 10 o'clock on the Eastern Seaboard. And I'm just so thrilled that we have someone that's so astute and so well-learned. And at the same time, the best part of all is that he can explain ideas that somehow resonate with a lot of people, but he makes them clear for those that may not comprehend. And I'm talking about none other than Robert Keston. So good morning, Mr. Keston. What a pleasure to have you on today.
Thank you, and good morning to you.
Good morning. Well, you know, I get a sense that there is a change in the political milieu, the environment that we live in, not only in New York State, but certainly the whole country. This has been brewing for quite a few years. Maybe it was thrown out there more than ever before under the new administration with President Trump. But it's not, he may just be like a catalyst in one way. But what is the divide and why are we divided as a nation? Democrats seem to point out that they're more left-wing. The Republicans, even though they have tried to be right-wing, and they are in many cases, they're not as they haven't moved to the extremes as much as the left has. So what's driving all of this that's going on, assuming that my introduction is correct?
Well, I don't normally like to disagree with you, but I would on this point, in that I think that the extremes of both parties have moved about as far as they possibly can. Certainly, with the right denying climate issues, you know,
yes,
making every single immigrant a scapegoat for everything that's wrong in the country. I think that those are clearly extremist positions that we haven't seen, you know, in quite a number of years in this country. Not that any of what is going on is new, because it's not, but certainly social media and the internet make it so that we're bombarded with all of this stuff all of the time. What's most unique, I think, is that the Democratic Party and the unaffiliated are growing in size. The Republican Party is shrinking in size. Because the extremists, on the right are so extreme, and it really has become more the party of Trump than the Republican Party. Mainstream Republicans are finding it very hard to call the party home, and people like Mitch McConnell make it extraordinarily difficult because they should know better, and yet for victory, they will sell out the country, whereas. In previous generations, they would reach across the aisle to try and save the country, even if they didn't always help their party to its full advantage. So I think that those are differences. What's also interesting is how it's playing out in states. Governor Cuomo, according to recent polls, is at his lowest popularity ever, which matches the president. So there really is a disconnect between the public and the leaders, party leaders, government officials, and whatnot. So it'll be interesting to see how all of this plays out. But Cuomo continuously does things that diminish his popularity. Maybe that helps the legislature regain some of its power. It's hard to know because it's still too early in the game. But certainly the relationships between the legislative branch and the executive branch are not what they were prior to the 2018 election winners taking office.
That makes a lot of sense, and I don't disagree with my introduction. I think it's because I didn't explain it well. And not to defend it, I get the impression that on an individual basis, we have more protagonists out there on the Democratic left that are infusing the discussion and it's more left leaning. The Republicans are taken, I guess they've taken the lead of the president, and he's become almost the lone spokesman, and the others just agree with him or say nothing, so they acquiesce. But I think it's more interesting what the Democrats are doing is because Democrats with the new leftist concepts that are being infused into the discussion are much more vital. They're making more sense, but they also captivate a younger audience and a younger voter. Why is that?
Well, for one thing, and once again, I would say that what's being proposed very often isn't new. You know, one of the big things is free college tuition at state and public institutions. Well, City University of New York at one time was free. So it's a return to a time and place in history when things were probably at their most successful. It's not new. I think that people are inclined to like that because after cars, I guess, university debt is the highest debt ratio in the country right now. So knowing that you're a young person going to college or wanting to go to college and either being saddled with hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt or tens of thousands of dollars of debt, knowing that there's the possibility, even the possibility, of free tuition at a state or local school is overwhelmingly appealing. Whether it's left or right, I think it appeals to people's basic needs for survival because we know in the 21st century, a basic education isn't even good enough anymore. Once again, healthcare, there's nobody in the United States or anywhere in the world who doesn't understand the value of good healthcare. And all our government has been willing to talk about is the value of access to insurance. So once again, it wouldn't be at all a surprise that young people who may have witnessed their parents or grandparents grappling with the high costs of healthcare and senior care and care for the elderly, why wouldn't they want the government to be more forthcoming in either providing it or providing access so that it becomes affordable versus the way it is today, which is leading people to bankruptcy or deciding between pills and food or pills and rent or even going to an eye doctor or even going to a dentist, since those are less likely to be covered even in the bad plans that we had, that we now have available to us.
Well, that's very compelling the way you express it, and I think it's very right the way it is being expressed. I was shocked only recently to learn that people in their 60s are still paying off their college tuition. That was like a mind-boggling circumstance to recognize. So I guess, though, and you're right about the fact that these are concepts that have been part of our lifestyle in America for many years, and then for some reason, and I don't know exactly what it was, we moved away from that and haven't been here long enough to really understand why we moved away from old concepts. But the question then becomes, isn't all of this then financially based? How does one change the direction of a nation that has somehow allowed itself to get where it is today? It's not competitive because we don't have health insurance. Labor is saddled with not having health insurance, so the cost of a car built in America is $1,500 to $2,000 more per car than it is from other countries because they have government health insurance. That's all part of what's already there, so they don't have to charge more. So how do we get to something that's more reasonable? And I don't even know why and how we got to the point of politicizing climate change when I don't, you know, even I'm a pretty smart guy, but I have no clue if the figures are correct, and I don't even know why it became a political situation. you know, either the scientists are right or they're wrong, but I can't judge what the scientists know. I don't have that capacity or the knowledge. So how do you
But I don't even think that at this moment in time that you need to be a scientist to recognize the changes.
No.
Exactly. You know, certain kinds of trees are dying out. Certain kinds of species are moving because they can't survive with the changes. We're experiencing weather in the Northeast that was reserved for the South or the Midwest that we rarely have ever had, and now we have on a regular basis. There's no question that things are changing and have changed. And we can see directly where humans have contributed to those changes because of pollution in the air, in the water, the islands that have been created in the oceans of plastic. You know, so there's no question that at least on certain scales, massive scales, 7 billion people have contributed grotesquely to the changes in climate and climate contributes to those weather changes.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't have to be a scientist anymore to see that the oceans are rising, that the storms are worse, that what was supposed to be a 100-year storm or a 1,000-year storm is now coming with far greater regularity. So we argue these things and they've become political for one reason and one reason alone, and that's money. The people who are making money off the system the way it is want the system to continue as it is, and the people who are watching everything that they've struggled for or hoped for be dissipated by these rapid changes in finance, in environment, in culture, are starting to push back because the wiggle room for survival is getting to be less and less. So when you no longer feel that you and your family have an opportunity, you're going to start to hit back. And if the haves don't give up some of what they have, well, the have-nots are going to hit back harder and stronger and for longer periods of time. The United States hasn't hit the position where Venezuela is. We haven't hit the position of certain other countries around the world, so we're not hitting back in the same way as of yet. But more and more Americans feel under stress, more and more feel that it's harder to survive from day to day. And the more that happens, the more you're going to see people start to take to the streets rather than just signing petitions online. And that will start to resonate with elected officials whose comments will no longer be enough. You know, lots of people will say, well, that political candidate or that office holder, well, they made a great statement. Well, at some point, statements made by political leaders are going to start to sound like thoughts and prayers from people after a gun shooting. And when that starts to happen, we'll start to see the significant change that we need to see in the legislative branches and the executive branches across the country.
Well, that's also just very well said. Who's supposed to respond at this point? Is it the politicians that stand before us who are vying for political office, and the new breed of people are going to recognize that? And the disgust and the disgruntlement and the lack of potential that's robbed of a lot of people, is that going to be reflected in the voices that we hear? Is the Bernie Sanders, I understand he announced today that he is running for president. Is that a socialist concept that he's bringing forward, or these are just standard ideas that shouldn't be labeled a socialist as if that's supposed to be a bad word? Can we engage socialism as presented by the Bernie Sanders of the world without dismantling the whole economic concepts that are incorporated here in the United States, or should that also be resurrected in a different way?
Well, I always find it amusing to some extent when people start to put kinds of labels on the political structures that we have. You know, capitalism in the United States has gone through any number of changes. You know, Teddy Roosevelt mm-hmm. broke up the trust, and this one did that, and this one did that. So free-form capitalism has never worked all that well and has always been overlooked by political leaders from the conservative to the liberal. And all of them know that unsupervised, blatant, outright capitalism leads to the control of the economy by very few people. Any business person knows that you do not want to rely on one customer, because if something happens to that customer, you go out of business. Every nonprofit understands you don't want to rely on one donor, because if something happens to that donor, you go out of business. Every citizen has to understand that if we rely on one company or one firm or one point of view, the country is going to have problems. And that's sort of what we're seeing. And we're grappling with what we do with the people who control the internet and control social media and control the newspapers, because mm-hmm. we are starting to see concentration once again is more problematic and more anti-democratic, not the party, but the concept of democracy, than we can afford as a nation. So how long will Facebook and Microsoft and Google be able to remain as fiefdoms? It's hard to say. How long will it be that corporations can buy up all the newspapers and then fire the journalists and just use them for their own purposes? We will see. Mm. But as television and newspapers and radio stations get bought up by conglomerates, we're starting to see the problems that this leads to in terms of getting accurate, useful information. They don't cover things. They cover selective things. They cover things in certain mm-hmm. ways. And the people who pay the price are average citizens who then have to try and go and find that information out in other ways. And then that leads to either even greater divides between those who want to believe no matter what and those who then doubt everything because they trust no one.
Mm-hmm. Well, we are definitely then at a crossroads, aren't we? Is it going to become the American revolt an American Spring, so to speak, like they had in the Arab world? It was an Arab Spring, and that all had to do with the structure of government that ended up not affording people an opportunity to earn a living, and education that was unaffordable, or even if you had the education, there were no jobs that you could become engaged in, and it got to the point where even people couldn't marry because they couldn't afford marriage. They couldn't even go through that whole process. Are we heading in that direction?
Well, for many Americans, we're already in that position. You know, there are parts
yes.
of the country that are not affordable for young people or old people. And
yeah.
we see that New York loses more people than any other state in the union. Even with the number of people who move here, we're likely to lose 2 congressional seats after the census in 2020. So we can't afford that as a state. We can't afford it politically, and we can't afford it economically. You can't make a state exist where the people who retire, who take their pensions and go to a place where they can afford to live because they can't afford to age at home. And
mm-hmm.
yet we still don't really look at what we can do to make it possible for people to live a good life in the places they want to live. That is going to be problematic. And when the old and the young face the same insurmountable problems, you may not have an Arab Spring, but you're going to have a New York winter, which will get
yeah.
people equally motivated. And New York certainly isn't alone. California is unbelievably expensive. New Jersey is expensive. Pennsylvania is getting expensive, or parts of Pennsylvania. Massachusetts is expensive. And we also have a misconception of what expensive is. Normally we think of these places as being expensive because of the taxes, but very often those taxes make other things more affordable. So it's the tax structure that may need to change, not necessarily the amount of money that's collected. It's how it's collected and who it's collected from. And we have this horrid fear that every rich person is going to move if you raise taxes on the wealthy. But there are an awful lot of wealthy who have said, I have enough money that the difference of paying 70% above making $10 million really isn't going to be the factor that's going to determine where I live or where I declare my permanent residence. So we have to be realistic in what it does. And we also have to be better at educating people about what that money goes to do. The people who pay taxes, the people who pay the most taxes, not necessarily being the people who make the most, but the people who make the most are benefiting from the system as it is. They are benefiting because other people are using the systems to get to places in order to make those people's lives even better.
Mm-hmm.
It only makes sense that those people share justly in the costs. So, yes, if you're making $10 million a year, there's probably a good chance that you're not taking the subway. But people who serve you day in and day out are using the subway, and they're using the buses, and they're being priced out of using those forms of transportation. So either you step in now, or you watch the total deterioration of your society. So that is really where the question is. How much are you willing to pay in order to maintain your lifestyle? Not how much are you willing to pay because you're being overtaxed.
Mm-hmm.
And we haven't gotten to that point. You know, we haven't gotten to that point, and we don't even have that kind of discussion. The governor says, no, we can't have a tax on the rich because they're leaving in droves. Well, they're not leaving in droves simply because of the taxes. They're leaving in droves because the quality of life is deteriorating as more and more people can't afford to live here and do the jobs that need to be done. So in New York City, people are still moving in because there still is transportation. In upstate, and in much of Westchester, there is no transportation. So either you have a car or two cars, and you have to pay insurance, and you have to do this, and you have to do that, and you have to pay the cost of fuel. And now we have this problem with Con Edison. Con Edison is saying that they can't provide gas. Shocking that they would only discover this when it becomes a crisis.
Exactly.
That they didn't know this was going to happen. And we have gas pipelines crisscrossing parts of the state. So something doesn't make sense. And are we asking the right questions? Are we doing the right things? Are we exploring the ways around this? So our government officials, rightly or wrongly, no opinion, are saying, well, we've got to now move some of those people who are heating with gas back to oil. Well, we know what that will do to the environment, but yet what are the options? We're not really looking at what the possibilities are to create a Manhattan-like project to move us forward rather than to try and move us back in the past. Yes, we may be hitting a crisis, but that is the best time to move forward. So why don't we do that? Why don't we look at ways that we can invest in what is coming down the pike rather than trying to save ourselves by reverting to just what we know? That doesn't always make the most sense. And at a time when you have to do something, that's the time when you really should do something rather than run backwards in fear.
Well, it does seem as though the mechanisms of oversight that we are told have always existed
do not seem to exist. When you wonder why it would take Con Ed supposedly 5 years to figure this this circumstance out, it really comes to question whether they're watching or whether they're orchestrating these outcomes. I thought that based on their telling, that they first said that they couldn't get a supply of gas, but that's absurd because they can get new places from which to get gas. They just don't seem to have the infrastructure laid out so that they could incorporate gas. And we've known that gas has been less expensive, and people were moving away from oil for health reasons and for economic reasons. And so why don't we have oversight committees that will actually protect the public interest? They seem to be working for other interests. It certainly doesn't seem to be the public interest anymore. How did we get that removed from the public?
Well, you have to wonder if they ever were serving the public interest. And the consumer boards in Albany are appointed by the governor. The governor gets big contributions from a lot of these corporations.
Yeah.
One of the reasons he's probably not very popular today. So if you're appointing people and you're taking money from those corporations, then what kind of people are you appointing? You know, we see in Washington mm-hmm. where it's very clear that industry people are being appointed to government positions that are supposed to have oversight over those corporations. So we're not necessarily mm-hmm. appointing experts. We're appointing people that have a business interest. And then they leave those positions and they go back into the industry that they were overseeing or supposedly overseeing.
Right.
So the conflicts are manifest and are as obvious as ever. And when you have that kind of conflict of interest, the people are definitely at the bottom of the totem pole in terms of being served. And business interests, which historically have been of primary concern to government, get first dibs at everything. So the fact that they don't know, the fact that, look, I mean, this is the first winter, and so far, that we haven't had a week of power outage. So, granted that last year it happened in March, and March hasn't yet come our way, so anything is still possible. Con Ed, that was NYSEG. What major changes have any of those companies put forth to protect us from something as catastrophic as what happened last year? When it was storm after storm, knocking out power for tens of thousands of people. So we still don't even know what the state has worked out with these corporations to protect us from the same kind of storm coming again. So if we don't know those things, why are we surprised that Con Ed would come back and say, oops, by the way, we can't provide gas to any new construction, and we may not be able to provide gas to our existing customers. So forget about pipelines and access that way. Now we're going to have trucks or vans or tankers scattered around the county so that when there's an emergency, we can hook them up to that. Well, we're worried about terrorism. We're worried about crime. We're worried about all these things. And we're going to have large containers of natural gas scattered around. I mean, does that make any sense? So there are just too many things that seem incongruous with the way things are in the world today. And yet still, where is the major investment in going to clean and renewable energy when we have a crisis that allows us to say, okay, we have an energy emergency of some sort or another. Why aren't we investing in the future? Why aren't we saying instead of putting money into this, retrofitting for oil, why don't we look at what's possible today and tomorrow to make sure that we're on the cutting edge rather than going back to the 20th century?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, when when you give expression to all these concepts that are very true, I concur with you. How do you live in the society where you realize that government hasn't been responsive for such a long time, and it's getting worse every day? I don't even know anymore what the right thing is with respect to that Amazon deal. I think that was just the public got nothing out of it, and we may not even be able to pay off a lot of the promises that the state had suggested that they would in time be able to fulfill, like such as the cost of education. If we had like a $27 billion return on a $3 billion inducement, does that make sense? When we only owe about $4.4 billion in education up to now, how do we rationalize all of this stuff? And what do we need to do to change our society in order to make it work?
Well, the first thing that became obvious with the Amazon deal was that without transparency, the public is no longer just going to sit there and take it. Now, unfortunately, the Amazon thing became a bigger political issue between enemies, political enemies, rather than just a discussion on the merits of Amazon, yes or no, or Amazon negotiation. So we know that Senator Mike Gianaris and Governor Cuomo really dislike each other immensely. So the fact that this was going into Mike Gianaris's district opened the door for a political fight that also allowed Andrea Stewart Cousins to show that she was not going to be a puppet of the governor. And this became a political issue even beyond whether Amazon was a good thing or a bad thing. The fact that the mayor and the governor took it upon themselves to do this in secret, bad idea, policy, bad politics. They created a situation that never needed to occur, and that was shameful on their part. Both of them had ambitions that they thought that they were doing the right thing. Whether they thought they were doing the right thing for the people or for themselves, who knows? But without the transparency that's necessary in government going forward, it's never going to work out well. And it opens the door for political infighting that just makes it worse. It's not gone unnoticed that also in the governor's proposed budget that he wants to have community groups, activist groups, declare themselves to be lobbyists. You know, so once again, he's showing his true colors. If you spend $500 a year on doing anything that might impact policy, he wants you to have to declare that you're a lobbyist. Well, $500 in today's world could mean gas going back and forth to Albany, or going back and forth to meeting your local elected officials, or buying pizza for your friends. These are voluntary groups that he wants now to have to declare themselves lobbyists. It doesn't bring a lot of money to the budget. All it does is make it harder for people to speak out against the governor. Once again, it is no surprise that this guy's popularity is dropping precipitously day in and day out as people discover who he really is. The only sad thing is that people didn't realize this before the elections in 2018.
Right. Very true. Well, you know, I could go on with talking to you for hours because it's just really there's so much really to discuss. So I can't wait to speak to you again in a couple of weeks. And I really want to thank you for setting a better perspective on what's been happening, because I think we're going to see that. This seems to be the beginning of a revolution that's been simmering for quite a few years, but it's now starting to form on the political landscape. It'll be very, very interesting to see how we all survive it.
Indeed. Thank you, and have a real good week.
You too, sir. Thank you very, very much. So,
all right. Bye-bye.
Very compelling, as always, with Robert Keston. He's so lucid and so aware on so many different levels of the complexity of these issues, and each one has an integral part to play and does play in the political platform that we see being expressed in the political landscape. So just really, really fascinating. I'm always thrilled to speak to him. Brilliant man. Want to go on to some other issues with you. Let's first find out what's going on in the Yonkers Tribune, and then we'll be back.
The Yonkers Tribune, named Home of the Acid-Tongued Bloggers by the New York Times, is a multifaceted news organization dedicated to keeping the citizens of Yonkers and Westchester informed via the internet and radio. Hezzy Aris is the tireless publisher, editor, and radio host of the Yonkers Tribune. He is a balding, bearded gnome, equipped with a digital camera and a steno pad at all times. Hezzy is frequently spotted in local meetings, translating the events into a Baroque prose style with an infusion of well-mannered outrage. The Yonkers Tribune attracts an informed, well-educated, affluent audience who hungers to know more about politics in all its permutations and nuances. Politics, says Hezzy, is our forte. Advertising inquiries are always welcome. Please call Hezzy Aris at 914-562-0834 or send an email to ehezi@hush.com.
Welcome back. If you're interested in reaching out to the Yonkers Tribune, they have another number. It's 347-415-4326. 347-415-4326. You can call them. You can text them. What else? And you can leave a message. So that's all there at that new number, 347-415-4326. So what I want to do is now move on to some international news that is taking place. One thing that was really interesting is there's a watchdog group that has suggested that the Danske Bank, the Estonian branch, be closed due to the scandal that took place there. So Estonia's banking watchdog, they call themselves FSA, like the letter F, the letter S like sugar, and the letter A, FSA, today said it had ordered Denmark's largest lender, Danske Bank, to close its local branch within 8 months following a money laundering scandal. Well, investigators in Copenhagen, Brussels, London, and the United States are probing some 2 billion euros, that's $226 billion, in transfers that passed through the Estonian branch between 2007 and 2015, involving some 15,000 foreign clients. Last December, Estonian authorities detained 10 former Danske employees on suspicion that they had facilitated money laundering via non-resident clients, including many Russians. We have every right to put an end once and for all to this very exceptional and unfortunate case, FSA, which stands for Financial Supervision Authority, head Kilvar Kessler said in a statement today. The Financial Supervision Authority gave Danske Bank 20 days to submit an action plan for closing the branch. Mm. On Monday, the European Banking Authority announced it was opening a formal investigation into a possible breach of European Union laws by the FSA and its Danish counterpart, Finansstilsenet, over the case. And Kessler said that the scandal had, quote, dealt a serious blow to the transparency, credibility, and reputation of the Estonian financial market, while the supervisory authority of the home country has handled the bank softly. And it's, end quote. Last November, Danish prosecutors brought preliminary charges against Danske Bank for violating money laundering laws between February 7 and January of 2016, Don Skavank has acknowledged that much of the money that went through the branch during the period may need to be treated as suspicious in origin. At the end of 2018, the Estonian branch had around 14,700 depositors in Estonia and 12,300 borrowers. Estonia's central bank said on Tuesday, today, the shutdown would have little effect on the Estonian economy, as Danske Bank had stopped providing services to private individuals back in 2015. In April of 2018, Danske Bank announced it had stopped opening new accounts for local businesses in the Baltic state. So, very, very compelling situation there. Wanted to look at some things that are happening more so here, but that was with regard to money laundering. That was just absolutely amazing. Well, Bernie Sanders announced his 2020 White House bid. Seems that Senator Bernie Sanders today announced he's running for president, launching a second bid for the White House after a surprisingly strong run for the Democratic nomination back in 2016. Sanders, who's 77, made the announcement in a radio interview in his home state of Vermont. "I wanted to let the people of the state of Vermont know about this first," Sanders said on Vermont Public Radio. The self-described Democratic socialist joins an already crowded field of candidates seeking to take on President Donald Trump and the Republicans in 2020. Sanders gave an outline Tuesday of how he will campaign. Quote, "And what I promise to do is, as I go around the country, is to take the values that all of us in Vermont are proud of, belief in justice, in community, in grassroots politics, in town meetings. That's what I'm going to carry all over this country," he said. He called Trump a national embarrassment and a pathological liar. Quote, "I also think he's a racist, a sexist, a homophobe, a xenophobe, somebody who is gaining cheap political points by trying to pick on minorities, often undocumented immigrants," Sanders had said. Sanders, an independent who caucuses with Democrats, made an unsuccessful bid for the presidency, if you remember, back in 2016, losing out to Hillary Clinton, who was in turn defeated by Donald Trump. Like Trump, Sanders was an outsider when the 2016 presidential primaries began, but he came close to pulling off an upset over Clinton. He garnered passionate support among young liberals with his calls for universal health care, a $15 minimum wage, and free public university education. Sanders served in the House until 2006 when he was elected to the U.S. Senate. He was reelected in 2012. And 2018. Very, very compelling set of circumstances there. Now, bear with me a moment as we move on to some other issues, of course. Where is it here? Yes. This is interesting because, again, here in the United States, quite a few United States states are suing Trump over his border wall funding. It seems that a coalition of 16 U.S. states, led by California, sued President Donald Trump and top members of administration yesterday to block his decision to declare a national emergency to obtain funds for building a wall along the U.S.-Mexico border. The lawsuit filed in U.S. District Court for the Northern District of California came after Trump invoked emergency powers on Friday to help build the wall that was his signature 2016 campaign promise. Trump's order would allow him to spend on the wall money that Congress appointed for other purposes. Congress declined to fulfill his request for $5.7 billion to help build the wall this year. Today, on President's Day, we take President Trump to court to block his misuse of presidential power, California Attorney General Xavier Becerra had said in a statement. We're suing President Trump to stop him from unilaterally robbing taxpayers' funds lawfully set aside by Congress for the people of our states. For most of us, the office of the presidency is not a place for theater, said Becerra, a Democrat. The White House declined to comment on the filing. In a budget deal passed by Congress to avert a second government shutdown, nearly $1.4 billion was allocated toward border fencing. Trump's emergency order would give him an additional $6.7 billion beyond that, lawmakers authorized. Three Texas landowners and an environmental group filed the first lawsuit against Trump's move on Friday, saying it violated the Constitution and would infringe on their property rights. The legal challenges could slow Trump's efforts to build the wall, which he says is needed to curb illegal immigration and drug trafficking. The lawsuits could end up in the conservative-leaning U.S. Supreme Court. Colorado, Connecticut, Delaware, Hawaii, Illinois, Maine, Maryland, Minnesota, Nevada, New Jersey, Mexico, New York, Oregon, Virginia, and Michigan joined California in the lawsuit. The states said that Trump's order would cause them to lose millions of dollars in federal funding for National Guard units dealing with counter-drug activities and redirection of funds from authorized military construction projects would damage their economies. In television interviews on Sunday and Monday, Becerra said the lawsuit would use Trump's own words against him as evidence that there was no national emergency to declare. Trump said on Friday he did not need to make the emergency declaration but wanted to speed the process of building the wall. That comment could undercut the government's legal argument. By the president's own admission, an emergency declaration is not necessary, the state said in the lawsuit. The federal government's own data prove there is no national emergency at the southern border that warrants construction of a wall. Unbelievable. So that's one of the things that's been going on, and that's being said. So let me just quickly look to see what else is happening on the world stage. Bear with me. This is also happening in the Americas. And this is interesting because Brazil's Bolsonaro has sacked a close ally amid campaign financing scandal. It seems that Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro on Monday sacked a close aide who helped get him elected after a storm within his party over suspected improper campaign financing. The allegations are the latest scandal to hit the party of the far-right president who comfortably won elections last October, in large part by vowing to stamp out corruption. Bolsonaro, quote, has decided to dismiss as Davo Bibiano as Minister of the General Secretariat of the Presidency, spokesman Otavio Rogero Barros told a news conference in Brasilia, the capital. The spokesman did not explain the firing, saying it was a personal decision, end quote, by Bolsonaro. Bolsonaro did not clarify much further in a video he released later that was broadcast by Brazilian media. He said only that, quote, different points of view on relevant issues brought a need for a re-evaluation, end quote. The president recognized Bibiano had played a vital role in this election campaign. Quote, his work was important to our success, Barros had said. The sacking could impact legislative passage of an upcoming bill Bolsonaro is to present to Congress this week to reform Brazil's unsustainable pension system. The reform is considered by investors to be the most crucial promise the president made to overhaul Latin America's biggest economy. Bibiano, who held a cabinet rank and was a former leader of the ultra-conservative PSL party, was replaced by a retired general, Floriano Peixoto, boosting to 8 the number of military men running Bolsonaro's 22 ministries. As chief of the ruling PSL party, Bibiano had been a key figure in Bolsonaro's campaign last year that led to the 63-year-old politician being elected in October elections. When Bolsonaro took office at the beginning of January, he rewarded Bibiano with the ministerial post by his side in the presidential palace. But that close alliance was strained after a newspaper, the Folha de São Paulo, reported that the PSL was thought to have nominated fake candidates in the general election to divert public funds to its coffers. Bibbiano had denied involvement and sought to downplay the crisis. He also said he had spoken several times with Bolsonaro while the president spent the first half of this month in hospital recovering from stomach surgery. But one of Bolsonaro's sons, Carlos Bolsonaro, who is a state legislator in Rio de Janeiro, said Bibbiano was lying, quote unquote, and no such discussion took place. Mm-hmm. He also said he had asked for a police investigation of Bibbiano. That triggered ructions in the PSL and among allies of the president, who questioned why Carlos, who has no position in the presidency or federal government, was permitted to act that way against Bibbiano. After several days of back and forth among top officials, Bolsonaro, who campaigned on pledges to clean up political corruption, acted yesterday by firing Bibbiano. Bolsonaro's reputation has been further sullied by suspicions of illegal financial transactions surrounding another of Bolsonaro's sons, Flavio, who is a senator. A third politician's son, Eduardo, a federal lawmaker, has embraced a nationalist politics platform created by Steve Bannon, U.S. President Donald Trump's former strategist. Bibbiano's dismissed, anticipated by investors, prompted a 1.04% fall in the stock market on Monday and a dip in the value of the Brazilian real current. That's their currency. Unbelievable. So let's just move on to there are more things that are happening on the local scene. Bear with me a moment. And this, of course, has much to do with Venezuela. Trump has warned the Venezuelan military to abandon Maduro, quote, or lose everything, end quote. U.S. President Donald Trump yesterday warned members of Venezuela's military who remained loyal to socialist President Nicolas Maduro that they are risking their future and their lives and urged them to allow humanitarian aid into the country. Speaking to a cheering crowd, mostly Venezuelan and Cuban immigrants in Miami, Trump said if the Venezuelan military continues supporting Maduro, quote, you will find no safe haven, no easy exit, and no way out. You'll lose everything, he said. Maduro retaliated late on Monday that Trump's speech was Nazi style, quote unquote, and said he acted as if he were the owner of Venezuela and his citizens his slaves. Trump offered strong backing for Venezuelan opposition leader Juan Guaido, whom the United States, many of Venezuela's neighbors, and most Western countries have recognized as interim president of Venezuela. But Maduro, who won a second term last year in an election that critics denounced as a sham, retains the backing of Russia and China and control of Venezuelan state institutions, including the security services. Trump cautioned Venezuelan armed forces not to harm Guaido or other opposition politicians, urged them to accept the National Assembly leader's offer of amnesty, and demanded that they allow in food, food, medicine, and other supplies. Well, Guaido, who invoked constitutional provisions to declare himself the country's leader last month, has said that aid will enter Venezuela from neighboring countries by land and sea on Saturday. The United States has sent tons of aid that is being stockpiled on Colombia's border with Venezuela, but Maduro has refused to let it in. Maduro called the aid a U.S. orchestrated show and denies any crisis, despite many Venezuelans' scant access to food and medicine. Quote, we will not make of the honorable Venezuela, of Venezuela, of beggars, and Cody said in a televised comment on Monday, we will not accept it. Maduro said that Venezuela already received humanitarian assistance on a daily basis. Russia, for example, was sending 300 tons of aid to the country by plane on Wednesday, he said, albeit clarifying this was not a donation, but supplies for which Venezuela has paid. We seek a peaceful transition of power, but all options are open, Trump said. It was a further hint of Trump's repeated insistence that military options remain on the table, though most Latin American experts believe such action is unlikely. The United States had direct communication with members of Venezuela's military, urging them to abandon Maduro. A senior White House official told Reuters this month that Trump's aides have openly predicted more defections. But so far, few military officers have turned against Maduro. A source in Washington close to the opposition expressed doubts whether the Trump administration has done sufficient groundwork to spur a wider mutiny in the ranks, where many officers are suspected of benefiting from corruption and drug trafficking. Guaido, in a videotaped message to the crowd of California International University, calls it a decisive moment to exert pressure on Maduro from inside and outside the country. Trump also used a speech to rail against socialism as a dying ideology in the Western Hemisphere and to brand Maduro a puppet of communist-led Cuba. While the Republican president did not directly equate socialism with the Democratic Party, as he appeared to in his State of the Union speech this month, he alluded to his earlier conviction of domestic policies proposed by some liberal Democrats. America will never be a socialist country, Trump said. Trump wants to boost support among Florida's Hispanic voters as he looks ahead to his reelection campaign in 2020, when Florida is again expected to be an important swing state. Fascinating turn of events. Bear with me a moment here. Okay. What I want to do, though, is quickly move on to the our studio screen. And let's see, we'll play for you what's going on with the Cabot Creamery, and then we'll be back.
Hey, you a judge?
Well, sorta. I report on cheese. I don't judge.
Well, I heard on the radio Cabot Cheddar always wins awards for taste.
Well, let me see my notes. Best taste? Check. Best texture? Check. The farm families in Cabot, Vermont have won every major award in the cheese world.
Every award?
Every.
What about the U.S. Cheese Championships?
Cabot's won that many times.
How about the American Cheese Society Contest?
Cabot won it.
World Cheese Championship Award?
Best in class on cheddar.
Fiery Food Challenge?
Cabot.
International Fancy Food Show?
Cabot rules.
The Stanley Cup?
That's hockey.
Oh.
Look, Cabot's won awards for best sharp, best light, best butter, and best cheddar.
Yeah, but a certain big cheese company's TV ad show, they won an award from judges wearing bright yellow lab coats.
Oh, those are actors.
Not real judges?
Real judges wear white lab coats.
They do?
Look, Cabot is best because they own the company, ship the milk, make the cheese. They won so many times, the real judges even asked one of Cabot's cheesemakers to be a judge.
I don't believe you.
Here, taste.
Hey, I can taste why Cabot's won every award.
You be the judge.
And I get to wear a yellow lab coat.
White lab coat. Check.
The best tasting cheddar on the planet is...
Time and time again.
Cabot Cheddar.
Check.
We're going to listen to a report by William Hildebrandt and Joanna Cockrell and Stephanie Cheval. This is a prelude to the anticipated historic second summit between the United States and North Korea. So listen in as we play this for you. Bear with me a moment. Okay, this should work. And a second, one moment. Okay. All right, here we begin. This should be about 12 minutes long.
Hello and welcome back to Asia here in France 24. I'm Will Hildebrandt. Coming up, after last year's handshake made history, critics want the second Trump-Kim summit to make progress. Washington and Pyongyang say they're ready to work in parallel. What does that mean for historic enemies? We'll speak to analyst David Kim from the Simpson Center. And it's called the Lifeline Express. For nearly 30 years, a train that's delivered free health care to India's poor. Powered by NGOs and private donations, it's treated over 10 million people. Now, it's been over 8 months since the first time a sitting U.S. president has ever met a North Korean leader. This time around, Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un are meeting in Vietnam and are under greater pressure to make concrete progress towards denuclearization. But ahead of the Hanoi handshake, Claire Rush takes a look back at how we got here.
Hanoi, the Vietnamese capital, will welcome Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un on February 27th and 28th for their second meeting in 8 months. Washington said it will be sending diplomatic teams to Asia to prepare.
We'll certainly talk about how we foster reduced tension, reduce military risk, take down that risk so that we can get peace and security on the peninsula as well.
According to media reports, the second summit's negotiations will expand on those of the first, held in June in Singapore. There, the U.S. called for total denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula and the repatriation of remains of U.S. soldiers killed in the Korean War. As for Pyongyang, it wants a lifting of U.S. sanctions, security guarantees, and a formal end to the Korean War, which was halted after 3 years of combat with a truce and not a formal peace treaty. Since June's meeting, the first between a sitting U.S. president and a North Korean leader, some progress has been made. Diplomatic ties have warmed. Pyongyang repatriated American soldiers' remains and reportedly stopped nuclear and missile tests, while Washington scaled back its war games with neighboring ally South Korea. But so far, no details have been given on the process of denuclearization. And the Pentagon warns it may still be far off.
Significant support, despite a reduction in tensions along the DMZ and a cessation of strategic provocations, coupled with public statements of intent to denuclearize, little to no verifiable change has occurred in North Korea's military capabilities.
Kim has expressed willingness to permanently dismantle nuclear facilities in Yongbyon, but only in return for corresponding moves from the U.S., which have yet to be specified.
Well, for more, we can speak to research analyst David Kim from the nonpartisan Stimson Center, a Washington-based think tank. David, why was Vietnam chosen as a setting for these talks?
Well, William, first off, Vietnam is an ally for both North Korea and the United States. North Korean fighters fought alongside the North Vietnamese during the Vietnam War, and the U.S. normalized relations, diplomatic relations, with Vietnam in 1995. Secondly, they have the security mechanism, security apparatus in place to host large summits such as these, as we saw at the APEC Leaders Summit in 2017, and also with President Obama's visit in 2016.
And David, Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un are going to be scrutinized in the second meeting. What's the result that both leaders would be happy with?
I'll start off by saying Kim Jong-un would like the lifting of sanctions, both the U.S. and U.N. Security Council resolution sanctions. We have 21 U.N. Security Council resolutions currently in place, 8 since North Korea's first test in 2006. So they are still in the squeeze, which helped them bring them to the table for negotiations last year. Also, I would say that they are looking for security assurances. This could be in the form of suspension of U.S. military exercises moving into 2019, and also possibly a peace declaration, which can help lead to the ending of the Korean War. This is symbolic, and so for President Trump, this is a big sell at home and to the international community. He will be able to declare an end to a war that has been going on technically since 1953, which ended in an armistice. And secondly, I would say for President Trump is that he needs to come out with a clear denuclearization roadmap and timeline and responsibilities for each party. We do not yet have a shared understanding of the definition of denuclearization, and that is critical to moving forward into Hanoi.
David, on the peninsula itself, and in Japan for that matter, what's the public opinion about these talks?
On the Korean peninsula, I think President Moon shares a broad support among his base. There are absolutely critics, especially from the Park Geun-hye administration and those conservative parties that are criticizing any move that President Moon is making. But we have to understand that the United States is the security guarantor for South Korea. And in that respect, I think we'll see continued support from the Korean public. In terms of Japanese public opinion, I would say they're a little bit more hesitant and skeptical of Kim Jong-un. I think the abductions issue is first and foremost for Prime Minister Abe, and that issue has not yet been resolved. So Prime Minister Abe will make it his priority to meet with Kim Jong-un or to have some kind of resolve to that issue.
David, there's one key player we haven't discussed yet, China. What's its role going to be moving forward?
I think China plays a critical role because they are one of three signatories that are needed to formally end the Korean War. Any signature will require China to get to a peace, a formal peace agreement. And also China has, President Xi has stated that he would like to be helpful in these talks moving forward. But with the looming U.S.-China trade disputes, that will be a difficult negotiation. We hope that China will not use that as a trump card, North Korea as a trump card moving forward.
All right. Thank you very much, David. David Kim from the Washington-based think tank, Stimson Center. Now, for three decades, a train has been delivering healthcare to India's most vulnerable people, the Lifeline Express, crisscrossing the large country and reaching some of its most isolated corners. It treated over 10 million patients, all for free. Catherine Viet has the story.
They come by the hundreds for a chance to board a train that will change their lives. Many here waiting for cataract surgery, like Cantabai. These are patients who can't afford surgery in a hospital or clinic, but the Lifeline Express, the world's first hospital train, provides free health care to those that need it. Since 1991, this train has been traveling from station to station, bringing medical care to the poorest and most remote areas of India. Once aboard, patients find a state-of-the-art, fully equipped hospital. The 10 doctors and 8 nurses all volunteer their time.
Your name?
Cantabai.
Patients are prepped for their procedures.
Oh,
I'm very happy, but I don't know what will happen during the operation. I'm a little frightened. I'm sweating.
Like in a hospital, the operation rooms are all sterile environments. But several procedures take place at the same time due to the number of patients.
Here we do around 80 to 100 operations a day. Each operation takes around 3 to 5 minutes. So that we can cover it faster.
The Lifeline Express team is proud of its state-of-the-art equipment, like this digital mammography machine.
Breast and cervical cancer are two major causes of deaths in females in our country. And this, going to rural areas, makes a huge difference.
There's equipment for eye exams, as well as a fully stocked dentist room. Cost nearly 1 million euros. The India Railways is responsible for the operation of the train in partnership with Impact India Foundation. The rest is completely financed by donations, including private companies in India and NGOs.
Impact that happens to patients is tremendous. We see life changing overnight. And Lifeline Express is called a magical train.
One of the challenges, getting the word out about the train to those who need it most. Volunteers crisscross the country announcing the train's arrival.
Lifeline Express.
In this village, flyers are being passed out.
Like this, it's about the free medical train.
Yeah,
back aboard the train, Cantabai's cataract surgery is over. She rests for a few minutes before reuniting with her husband. In a month, her eyesight will be back to normal. Over the past 30 years, Lifeline Express has performed around 130,000 operations and treated over 10 million patients across India.
Well, that's it for this week. But as always, you can find this program on our YouTube page or on our website, France France24.com. That's it. And thanks again for watching. Please stay tuned to France 24.
Okay, let's keep.
Every day, 300 people take to the road for a life of exile in the.
1 second, okay. This is very interesting as well. This is about Germany and France trying to push forward to create an industrial European champion. And this came about when Germany and France agreed today on a strategy to create European industrial champions, quote unquote, to seek changes in European Union competition rules that now prevent blockbuster mergers of homegrown groups. The push for a common industrial initiative came after the European Union's veto of an Alstom Siemens rail merger that has revived debate over competition regulations that critics say are obsolete in the face of growing rivalry from Chinese giants. It's an important day because after months of work, we have agreed to the definition of an industrial strategy for Europe, which will be proposed to our European partners, said French Economy Minister Bruno Le Maire in Berlin after talks with his German counterpart, Peter Altmaier. Under the strategy, the two European Union giants will push for greater investment in innovations, seek reforms of European Union competition rules, and set up mechanisms to better protect homegrown technology. As a first concrete project, both sides will cooperate in the production of electric batteries, an essential component in the race to electrifying automobiles. In the strategy outline published on Tuesday, France and Germany said that, quote, competition rules are essential, but existing rules need to be revised to be able to adequately take into account industrial policy considerations that can help European companies compete successfully on the world stage. The choice is simple when it comes to industrial policy. Unite our forces or allow our industrial base and capacity to gradually disappear, they said. And that is exactly what would happen if they don't become more competitive. Okay, so let's go back to what's happening here in the U.S. I think that we may have covered all the major issues here. And, okay, so I'm going to move on to different places along the globe in order to be able to get a better sense of what's going on. now, this is interesting. It seems that seven lawmakers have quit the United Kingdom's Labour Party over Brexit and anti-Semitism. It seems that seven British lawmakers quit the main opposition Labour Party on Monday over its approach to issues including Brexit and anti-Semitism, the biggest shakeup in years for one of Britain's major political parties. The announcement ripped open a long simmering rift between socialists and centrists in the party, which sees itself as the representative of Britain's working class. It's also the latest fallout from Britain's decision to leave the European Union, which has split both of the country's two main parties, Conservatives and Labour, into pro-Brexit and pro-European Union camps. Now, many Labour lawmakers have been unhappy with the party's direction under leader Jeremy Corbyn, a veteran socialist who took charge in 2015 with strong grassroots backing. They accused Corbyn of mounting a weak opposition to Conservative Prime Minister Theresa May's plans for leaving the European Union and of failing to stamp out a vein of anti-Semitism in the party. The splitters, who have between 9 and 27 years' experience in Parliament and represent constituencies across England, make up a small fraction of Labour's 256 lawmakers or of the 650 total members of Parliament, but this is the biggest split in the Labour Party since four senior members quit in 1981 to form the Social Democratic Party. Luciana Berga, one of those who quit Monday, said Labour had become institutionally anti-Semitic. I'm leaving behind a culture of bullying, bigotry, and intimidation, she said at a news conference alongside six colleagues. labor leaders have admitted that Berger, who is Jewish, has been bullied by some members of her local party in Northwest England. Labor has been riven by allegations that the party has become hostile to Jews under Corbyn, a longtime supporter of the Palestinians. Corbyn's supporters accuse political opponents and right-wing media outlets of misrepresenting his views. There have long been signs that British voters' 2016 decision to leave the European Union could spark a major overhaul of British politics. Mm-hmm. May's Conservatives are in the throes of a civil war between the party's pro-Brexit and pro-European Union wings. Labour is also split. Many Labour members oppose Brexit, which is due in less than 6 weeks on March 29, and want the party to fight to hold a new referendum that could keep Britain in the 28-nation bloc. Corbyn has spent decades criticizing the European Union before becoming a lukewarm convert to the Remain cause in the 2016 referendum. Is reluctant to do anything that could be seen as defying voters' decision to leave. I am furious that the leadership is complicit in facilitating a Brexit, which will cause great economic, social, and political damage to our country, said Mike Gapes, one of the departing lawmakers. Seven members of Parliament leaving Labour said they will continue to sit in the House of Commons as the newly formed independent group. Corbyn said he was disappointed that these ministers of parliament have felt unable to continue to work together for the labor policies that inspired millions at the last election and saw us increase our vote by the largest share since 1945. Labor lawmakers who quit in 1981 eventually became today's Liberal Democrats, a centrist party that has failed to topple the dominance of the two bigger parties. The new group, of seven stopped short of forming a new political party, but the seeds have been sown. The new group has a name, a website, and a statement of principles which argues for a mix of pro-businesses and social welfare measures and a pro-Western foreign policy that is closer to the new Labour of former Prime Minister Tony Blair than to Corbyn's old-school socialism. Their statement said the Labour Party now pursues policies that would weaken our national security, accepts the narratives of states hostile to our country, has failed to take a lead in addressing the challenges of Brexit, and to provide a strong and coherent alternative to the Conservative approach. Departing lawmakers said they would not be joining the Liberal Democrats and urged members of other parties to help them create a new centrist force in British politics. We do not think any of the major parties is fit for power, said lawmaker Angela Smith. People feel politically homeless and they are asking and begging for an alternative. Victoria Honeyman, a lecturer in politics at the University of Leeds, said that history suggests the breakaway group will struggle to gain traction in British politics. It's very cold out there as an independent, she said. It's all well and good leaving because you believe the party has moved away from you, but you can often achieve more from being inside the tent. So that's the story from there. Let's quickly look and see what else is happening on the world stage. And bear with me a moment. Bear with me a second here. It's not as easy as they think the Europeans balk at U.S. calls to repatriate jihadist fighters. Seems that U.S. President Donald Trump's demand that European countries take back their citizens fighting in Syria is receiving a mixed reaction as nations ponder how to bring home grown members of the Islamic State group to trial. The question of such foreign fighters has been a conundrum for the European for several years. Islamic State group prisoners could be exposed to torture or the death penalty if they remain in jail in Syria or Iraq, and the European Union opposes the death penalty. think I forgot we read this to you yesterday. So, but evidently it's still very, very much a pertinent issue on the international scene. Could take one quick other look to see if anything else has transpired. No, I think we've caught up. So, I think that's really it. Oh, this is interesting. I'm sorry, from a business perspective, it seems that the CEO of the company Huawei says, no way the U.S. can crush us, end quote. The CEO of Huawei has said the United States cannot crush the Chinese technology giant, despite the criminal charges the company is facing. So let's just hear the report on this particular issue. Bear with me a moment. This should take about 6 minutes to play.
Time now for the day's business news, and we're going to start with an interview given by the head of the Chinese technology giant Huawei. Our business editor, Stephen Carl, is with us to tell us all the details. Stephen.
Eve, the founder and CEO of Huawei, said efforts by the United States to block the Chinese company will not crush the firm. Reng Zhengfei was speaking to the BBC as the company faces increased scrutiny from governments over its links to the Chinese authorities. Now, U.S. authorities have indicted the company on criminal charges, including money laundering and stealing trade secrets. Mr. Ren's daughter was arrested in Canada as a result of those charges, an act that he describes as politically motivated. He says the company will continue to grow in spite of U.S. pressure.
There's no way the U.S. can crush us. The world needs Huawei because we are more advanced. Even if they persuade more countries not to use us temporarily, we could just scale things down a bit. And because the US keeps targeting us and finding fault with us, it has forced us to improve our products and services.
The carmaker Honda has confirmed that it's closing its factory in the English town of Swindon from 2021. A press conference with its CEO got underway a short time ago in Tokyo. 3,500 people work at the plant in Swindon, which is the brand's only manufacturing facility in the European Union. Honda says that it will keep its European headquarters in the UK, but will have no manufacturing facilities left in the country. CEO Takahiro Hachigo also announced that Honda will stop making its Civic sedan model in Turkey from 2021, but they're still planning to continue its business operations in the country after that. We're waiting to hear if he has anything to say about Brexit. Officially, the company has said that this decision is not Brexit related. Moving on, Europe's largest bank, HSBC, has disappointed investors by reporting profits below expectations for 2018. Its earnings before tax came in just below $20 billion. That's up 16% on 2017. But the bank's earnings towards the end of last year were hurt by the US-China trade dispute, which had sent shares in Hong Kong and mainland China tumbling. Chief Executive John Flint said that HSBC was prepared for the fallout from a deterioration in those trade tensions as well as from Brexit. But let's see how that news is going down on the markets. HSBC shares down over 2% at the open in London. We're also keeping an eye on shares from the mining giant BHP Billiton. They're down 2% as well after their results. This is the picture on the European markets at the open. Small falls across London, Paris and Frankfurt. Over in Asia, we had major gains on Asian markets on Monday. Things are a little bit calmer today, though, in trading. The Nikkei in Tokyo finishing up slightly. Shanghai just nudging into positive territory and some small falls in Hong Kong. And on the Kospi in Seoul, of course, trade the dominant issue for investors there. Over on the currency markets, the dollar stronger against the euro today, trading for $1.13 and just over 87 pence sterling as well. Now, here in France, many workers got a nice surprise at the end of last month. Employers have been taking advantage of a government scheme to give their staff tax-free bonuses of up to €1,000. It's a step that was announced by the French president last December as part of a package in response to the yellow vest protests. Catherine Viette has the story.
A little extra something in their paychecks for French workers. Many companies have accepted the French government's offer of handing out year-end tax-free bonuses up to €1,000. At this independent brewer in northern France, the 600 employees all received the maximum bonus.
We give €1,000. The employees receive €1,000 net, and that I find attractive. If there had been payroll taxes, I would not have given these bonuses.
According to a survey conducted by the National Association of Human Resource Managers, 74% of companies are choosing to pay the bonus. The average paid is €532. It's been smaller companies that have been handing out the bigger bonuses, €687 on average for companies with less than 50 employees versus €583 on average for companies with more than 1,000 employees. The head of this IT company chose to pay his 60 employees the full amount, saying it's a win-win.
€60,000 is a benefit for our employees' responsiveness. We are also working towards future performances, because this will help keep employees motivated to do a good job.
As for big companies, all but one on the CAC 40 stock market index has decided to pay the bonus. Many like telephone giant SFR and cosmetics brand L'Oreal have paid the maximum amount of €1,000. Others, such as Accor Hotels, have based the bonus amount on income. Companies have until March 31st to pay this bonus and take advantage of the tax exemption.
And then most of us dread getting letters from the tax man, but a man in Florida received a very nice surprise of a tax refund for $980,000. 29-year-old Ramon Blanchett filed a tax return in 2017 that claimed he paid $1 million of federal taxes on wages of just $17,000. The New York Times reported on the story here. Turns out, though, he was only paid just over $2,000 and actually paid no tax at all. But the Internal Revenue Service had already sent him the refund, which he kept until he was found out. Unsurprisingly, questions are now being asked as to why this unusually large payout didn't raise red flags earlier. Not a bad, you know, not a bad attempt, was it?
Well, he'll have to give it back, I imagine.
Oh, he has to give it back.
Yeah. Okay, thanks, Stephen Carl, for that business update.
Well, that's the story here. It's about 11:30 or close to it, so we're going to just want to quickly share with you who we have tomorrow. Yes, we're going to be speaking to Benjamin Sullivan. Benjamin Sullivan is a member of the Palisades Hudson Financial Group, and we're going to talk to him about taxes, and it's quite propitious at this time of the year. So tune in tomorrow at 10 o'clock when he'll be on. Until then, thanks for being with us. The best of a good day, and thank you again for being with us today. Goodbye.